This is Mae Brussel, and it's part two of World Watchers, program number 775. And I cited before Representative Pike's committee on hearings of the CIA and the media the opening introduction of former CIA Director William Colby telling about a kind of use they have of news media people, that is the gray area where fictitious people are cited as sources of information who do not in fact exist. And here is a precise example of United Press International using Nicholas Daniloff to try to get the people to vote against the resolution to investigate the murder of John Kennedy and Martin Luther King. Now, why would Nicholas Daniloff be interested in putting a wedge into the Rules Committee investigation? If this isn't his concern and he's not a spy, then how was he used this way? And the record clearly states that it was linked to Nicholas Daniloff. Being a spy or not, the news media didn't give a breather to the fact that everything is wrong with the Soviet Union and that the United States is right, and the arrest of Nicholas Daniloff unleashed a whole amount of articles. I don't even have time to cite them, and I'll give you some titles later or next week. One of the worst was Haynes Johnson, September the 10th, in the Washington Post, again, a newspaper that Daniloff worked for, called American Held Hostage, and he said after 10 days of silence, President Reagan pronounced Nicholas Daniloff's ordeal an outrage. Another kind of outrage permeates this case, the muted sense of protest that has surrounded it. And he goes on to say that he's been speaking in public places and nobody was even curious about Nicholas Daniloff. In the Daniloff affair, Reagan has reacted in familiar fashion for an American president confronted with an incident potentially affecting superpower relations in the nuclear age. Can you imagine Nicholas Daniloff being so important that he affects relationships in the nuclear age that we would almost bomb each other if this wasn't resolved? And Johnson says, like his predecessors, Reagan found it prudent to turn it over to private channels. And then finally he himself wrote to the Soviet Union about this. I don't mean to press editorial reaction or the expression and condemnation that was swift and strong, but what I want to say, said Haynes Johnson, is the silence of the public out there and not having any anger or seeming totally indifferent. He said, after World War II, it's true, we were told gentlemen don't read each other's mail, which was a lie. He said, after a succession of once seemingly unbelievable cloak and dagger episodes, over the post-war decades, along with events as Watergate, we have anesthetized the public. People are now conditioned to think that things are not always what they seem, which is good. Part of any skepticism is probably involved in the public image of the Soviet Union. It's not the sunshine and flowers that Mikhail Gorbachev wants to say. It is the real politic stamped in the minds of most people. How could the Soviets be so stupid, so heavy-handed, so patently working against their own self-interest, unless there was more to this than meets the eye? And the truth is, there is more to this than meets the eye, and the Soviet Union may not have been acting so heavy-handed, and they may not have been acting against their best interest, as evidenced by the fact that a summit was quickly called over this. But Haynes Johnson says the answer is simple. It is the Soviet way, from the bloody Stalin purges, the trumped-up trials of the 30s, the current era of attempted cover-ups over Chernobyl. The Soviets invariably demonstrate their contempt for the individual, employ brute force as a method of achieving their goals. Nicholas Daniloff is their latest victim, and America will be imprisoned until he is free. Now, these kinds of editorials, this is just one out of 40 or 50, which had such strong language, as if we didn't use reporters for the intelligence community. And just multiply that kind of editorial and article and ask yourself, what in the heck is going on that this man is so terribly important and the President of the United States is so frantic to get him home? September 30th, 1986, there was an article in the San Francisco Examiner, Russian Father's Nightmare Came Back to Haunt the Sun. And this is the gist of the article. When Nicholas Daniloff was born 51 years ago and the family had fled Russia to Paris, he grew up hearing stories of the Russian Revolution. He heard of his grandfather, the intelligence officer for the Tsar. Now Daniloff was going to Russia as a correspondent. He devoted much of his professional career to tracing his roots in Russia, and he worked as a correspondent for UPI 25 years ago, and that's 1961 when Oswald was at the Minsk Radio Factory, and I'll go back to that later, and he worked for U.S. News and World Report 5 years at that time. As I say, Oswald was in Moscow in 1961. The U-2 spy plane had been down before Danilov got there. CIA reporters such as Priscilla Johnson were working with Lee Oswald, and she was under the cover of the CIA and the State Department. She was in charge of Marina Oswald after John Kennedy was killed and Lee Harvey Oswald was killed. Priscilla Johnson, under the guise of a journalist, and I'll read you some of the documents from the National Archives, went to Harvard University, to the Soviet Department, and went into journalism. Nicholas Danilov was at Harvard University, graduated, as I said, and was sent to Washington. And Danilov is seen by the codename Zorro. Just one example, goodness knows what he was doing in those 7 years, was planning disinformation about a non-existent person because he doesn't want the Kennedy assassination opened up again. And being in Moscow in 1961 to 65, maybe he's afraid they'd get too close to that white Russian czarist Minsk radio factory connection that G. Robert Blakey carefully avoided. He was brought on to the House Select Committee on Assassinations, G. Robert Blakey. He is the attorney for LaCosta, for Mo Dalitz, and he wrote a book on his investigations blaming the mafia organized crime for killing Kennedy. Again, steering it from the Danilov czarist Russians in the Dallas-Fort Worth area in Minsk, at the Minsk radio factory, around the milieu of Oswald and through the press that were CIA and intelligence, he held the line down the second time in covering up these roots. And when Ronald Reagan was in office in 1981, and Alexander Haig was Secretary of State, and William Casey of the OSS and the Knight of Malta became head of the CIA, Danilov went back in 1981 to Russia to pick up some more pieces of propaganda, and he admittedly was mentioned by his wife. He didn't admit it. She said his articles were anti-Soviet in nature, and of course, U.S. News and World Report always is slanted along those lines. Now, Danilov says he's writing a book about his great-grandfather, I believe it was Alexander Krolov, who spent 30 years in Siberia because of a planned coup against the Tsar, and his father didn't talk to him much about the 1917 revolution, according to these brief sketches of his life, probably because they got their ass kicked out, and the Tsar and all those corrupt people around them were forced to leave. But he heard stories of Lenin's seizure of power and the terror that followed in the Russian Civil War, and his grandmother taught him Russian, and he was very anxious to continue his background in Russia and the family and to understand the Soviets, of course, so they could be deposed someday. And going to Washington and seeking a job in the government, he mentions the agencies he went to, but that doesn't mean that there weren't other agencies that didn't grab him right away. Now, Nicholas Danilov was picked up by the police in Moscow August the 30th, and 1 month later, he left Russia with his wife, and the San Francisco Examiner described after hard bargaining between the United States and Russia. Why the hard bargaining? Why couldn't it sit 1, 2, 3 weeks, a month? Why did he have to be out in a month? Why did Nicholas Danilov have to get out in such a hurry? Why did the President of the United States get involved so quickly? And Larry Speaks and George Shultz and a symphony of journalists. And why this hurried meeting of Ronald Reagan and Gorbachev that just took place? Who is Danilov? Now, Ronald Reagan wrote to Soviet leader Mikhail Gorbachev and assured him in his personal letter that Danilov is not a spy. And the Soviet Union didn't believe him, and Mr. Gorbachev responded a few days later, unafraid of Ronald Reagan, and said Danilov is a spy and he'll be tried. Now, Gorbachev has had some samples of Reagan's verities. Forget Richard Nixon. We're told the Contras are freedom fighters. He knows they're the Somozan Army, drug dealers, torturers that want to get back. We were told the Korean airline was shot down on purpose and they knew it was a civilian plane. And 3 years later, without blushing, the far right and the establishment media, everything from the Washington Times, Reverend Moon's paper, New York Times, and all the papers approve of Seymour Hersh's book, which says the Soviet Union didn't know it was a passenger plane. The reason they accept it is then, he says, but the CIA wasn't involved. The Soviet Union also knows that Maurice Bishop was not a threat to the United States or the Caribbean, or the runways for the airplanes were not for the Soviet Union to invade America or take South America, that they were for recreation and vacations. And they know that Muammar Gaddafi didn't arrange the Berlin disco bombings. It had to do with Syria and Lebanon. So these are current, easy to remember, overt lies. And when Ronald Reagan says he's not a spy, you send him home, Mr. Gorbachev just didn't respond. They responded by saying that Danilov was caught in the act. He spent 13 days in a Soviet jail, and according to the accounts, he almost cracked up. He lost his confidence, and he looked like a scared man, and he admitted he couldn't take it another day. Now, the background of Danilov from the San Francisco Examiner, continuing, says, as a college graduate, my thoughts focused primarily on diplomacy. Neither the U.S. Foreign Service, nor the CIA, nor the U.S. Information Agency, nor the military services wanted me. What he leaves out is there's the Defense Intelligence Agency. That's a very big agency. It's much larger than the CIA. There's the National Security Council, the National Security Agency. There are a lot of agencies that could use him. And again, just being a journalist or studying journalism and attending Harvard for 4 years, he was ripe for some job that would be influential in the Cold War, the anti-Soviet politic of our mentality since World War II. And as I say, in summer 1956, he took a job in the summer with the Canadian weather station in the North Pole. In 1956, he got his first journalism job with the Washington Post. Danilov went to Washington, D.C., and the Washington Post is a paper notorious for links with the intelligence community. I don't want to digress from the main story about Danilov right now. In 1957, as I put in the chronology, he left for Britain. He studied at the Magdalen College in Oxford, philosophy, politics, and economics. I don't see anything about journalism or writing courses. He joined the UPI in London. He moved to Geneva, Switzerland, went to Moscow a year later. And from Moscow, he came back to the United States. He stayed in Moscow in Russia from 1961 to 1965. Danilov was there, as I say, when Oswald was at the Minsk radio factory, and at the time that Oswald moved back to the Dallas-Fort Worth area and Marina got her permission cleared quickly through the government in Russia, and he was part of the American entourage, I'm sure, at the American embassy, being so active in the Cold War and anti-Soviet shtick. And in 1962, after the U-2 flight, the first American was tried there, Gary Powers. There was a lot of reason for journalism to be interested in CIA agents and defectors, which is part of a problem in the Soviet Union, Americans defecting that would catch the eye of a journalist at the time. And in 1964 was the Warren Commission. He was still over there, and as soon as the Warren Commission was completed, or while it was being completed, rather, as soon as Kennedy was killed, Yuri Nosenko came to this country. He was the agent in charge of the Oswald papers, and he came quickly to the United States by way of Switzerland, and Nicholas Danilov was over there in Moscow taking care of affairs for UPI. Again, UPI and Associated Press and all the newspapers carried the stories that Lee Harvey Oswald did it alone. In fact, the Warren Commission set up news councils and news reports as soon as their Warren Commission was finished to affect the press all over the world and reach them to assure them there was no conspiracy in the United States. In 1965, Danilov returned to Washington Post Foreign Desk, and then he worked for the Washington Post and went back to the UPI in 1965. Under the UPI, he worked for the State Department, the Defense Department, and the White House. Now, in that interim of the late 60s until 1973, were the murders of Robert Kennedy and Martin Luther King. Richard Nixon came in office 1968 to 74, and Danilov left right at the time of the Watergate scandals when Nixon was going to be impeached. He worked, as I say, for the State Department, the Defense Department, and the White House during the Richard Nixon years. And, of course, Nixon won the election from John Kennedy by way of bullets, because when he couldn't win in 1960, he was assured in 1968 And he was right there in power in the cover-up of the assassination of Kennedy that made Nixon's presidency possible in 1968 had to do with what happened in the Soviet Union, the role of Lee and Marina Oswald, and the people in the Dallas-Fort Worth area, their contacts, that created the illusion of a crazy Oswald for the purposes of taking away any possible motive that seemed more sinister or linked to the Defense Department, State Department, and White House, and Oswald was in contact with all of those. From 1973 to 74, Daniloff went back to Harvard and studied Chinese as a Nieman Fellow at Harvard. Now, missing from these biographies, maybe you've seen pieces of it. I haven't been able to find them. From 1974 to 1981, when Reagan was in power, he was, I don't know who he was working for. For all purposes, he left the Washington Post, and for all purposes, he left the UPI. But he had to be back working for UPI in 1977, or as a CIA person involved with and using UPI, because that's when he interrupted the House Select Committee assassination possibility of being put together when the Rules Committee was going to vote by having articles with a fictitious person involved, his name in the byline, hoping to say they're a bunch of crackpots who threaten the Speaker of the House, don't give them the power to open up the investigations. And he joined UPI in 1981 and returned to Moscow, where he has been. Now, one of the people that worked with Oswald in 1959, when he first got over there, but who was involved with espionage, was Priscilla Johnson McMillan, a graduate of Bryn Mawr. She got her master's degree at Harvard in Soviet area studies, fluent in Russian. She lived in the Soviet Union for 3 years. She wrote for Harper's Magazine at home, for The Reporter, The New York Times, and other publications. They took her material. Interesting enough that she had a lot of contact, of course, with Lee Harvey Oswald as soon as he got over there, and he was in touch with Marina after the time period when Daniloff had arrived and been in the Soviet Union a year, and Priscilla Johnson was every bit an espionage agent. Now, I have some documents from the National Archives again, like I shared with you last week with Dan Rather in Jack Ruby's nightclub, and I want to share these with you now and then get back to some of Mr. Nicholas Daniloff to show you that the CIA uses these agents, that they knew there was a lot more going on with the Kennedy assassination, and a lot of it involved the Soviet Union in the time period that Daniloff was over there representing UPI in Moscow, some before and some after. The memorandum that I'm going to cite first is from William T. Coleman, Jr., from the Warren Commission to Mr. W. David Slauson, another attorney of the Warren Commission, dated February the 14th, 1964. That was 1 month after they started taking testimony on the murder of John Kennedy. Quote, memorandum dated May 4th, 1962, just before Oswald came home, says that Oswald had not lost his citizenship. This is when he was going to be giving as a defector all the codes of the Pacific and so forth. This 62 is the time period Daniloff was in the Soviet Union. Another one, March 20th, 1962. Robert F. Hale recommends a waiver of Section 212 in regards to Marina Oswald. Another one, documents of interest in file marked 5. Memo for file dated November 17th, 1959. Oswald said that he would soon be trained in electronics in the Soviet Union. This is November 17th, 1959, and he does in fact go to electronic factory in Minsk run by Alexander Zeiger from Argentina, and he knew that he would be going into this factory in the Soviet Union. Now, this position of Priscilla Johnson interviewing him in November 16th, 1959 in the Soviet Union, she had a 5-hour interview view at the Hotel Metropole. Then the next day, she reports that Oswald, a defector, knows where he's going to be working in Minsk, and that somebody had set it up for him. So the next day, it's in the State Department papers. He hasn't even arrived in Minsk, and he's allegedly suicidal for wanting to stay in the Soviet Union, and they're not going to keep him there. And Oswald knew exactly who his employer would be. Another news story came out. This was from January 20th, 1976. Time magazine is out with excerpts from a book this week written by George McMullen that alleges that James Earl Ray was the lone assassin of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. McMillan alleges in the Time magazine article that Ray is a committed racist who planned to shoot Dr. King at least 4 years prior to the 1968 assassination in Memphis. McMillan writes that James Earl Ray's brother, Jerry, even received a call from James Earl Ray on the morning of the assassination, in which James Earl boasted he was going to kill the civil rights leader. Jerry Ray flatly denies this account, insisting he never told McMillan any such story. It's interesting to note that while George McMillan is connected to the James Earl Ray Martin Luther King case, his wife, Priscilla Johnson McMillan, was directly involved in the Lee Harvey Oswald investigation. According to Warren Commission records, Priscilla Johnson, claiming to be an American news reporter, interviewed Lee Harvey Oswald in Moscow in 1969. According to documents, however, her real mission was to interview Oswald, not from a news organization, but from the U.S. State Department. Critics of the new McMillan book on the King case say that McMillan's maintained undisclosed ties to U.S. intelligence agencies, both of them. And that was 1976, after the hearings of the House of Representatives on the news media. Here's another memorandum, February 14, 1964, from W. David Slauson from William Coleman, another one. I found the following to be of interest in the material sent over from the State Department. File 26, the telegram sent on June 28, 1963, in regarding persons who applied for a passport in New Orleans, Louisiana. Besides the name Lee Harvey Oswald is the word no. The memo dated October the 11th, 1963, indicates there is a file attached, but the file is not attached to the memo. The assassination will be the next month. In the passport application, Oswald applied for a passport to leave the country from New Orleans, and they're talking about that passport application he got in 24 hours. It said the only word written in connection with his occupation is with his occupation. Is this Oswald's handwriting? And then in May 62, when they were about to come home from the Soviet Union, they came in June 62, there's a memo written by Robert Johnson in which he states that based upon the evidence and information of record, Mr. Oswald has not lost his citizenship. I read that before. And Robert F. Hale, dated March the 20th, 1962, recommends a waiver of Section 212 to allow Mrs. Oswald into this country, and a memorandum March 28, 1960, stated that the appropriate notice was placed in the lookout card section of the passport office if Mr. Oswald came back. And, of course, as I say, Nicholas Daniloff went to the Soviet Union in 1961 and was very much a part of the scene when Marina Oswald were in Moscow requesting to come home, when the money was sent by the State Department and so forth. Now, one more little bit about Daniloff's background, his early background, before I get on to some of these other matters. This is the New York Times, rather, September the 9th, 1986. In 1961, when Nicholas Daniloff was going to the Soviet Union to represent the UPI, he told his father about it. His father remarked that he was the son of a Tsarist general, and he said, "You think your American passport is going to save you from the Bolsheviks? You are wrong. They are going to send you to the salt mines." Now, Daniloff's behavior is what could send him to the salt mines. It wasn't the fact that he had an American passport and that it didn't protect you if you were doing normal things. His activities in the Soviet Union, and I'll go into those, if not this week, next week, were very suspect, and he was found with maps of Afghanistan and markings of where bullet locations were and pictures of certain officers and so forth. He was in trouble because he was a spy. That sends you to the salt mines. Of course the American passport won't help you if you're caught as a spy. And Dad's warning him that his own father was a Tsarist general, went off to the salt mines. The grandmother, as I mentioned before, taught him Russian. She instilled in him a sense that he would go back to Russia. And, of course, that has been the dream of the white Russians, the Solidarists, the anti-Castro Cubans, Premier Qi, who wants to go back to Vietnam, the Chang family wants to go to the mainland of China. And the family, as I say, moved from Paris to Argentina. And I want to repeat again the incidences or the connections of Argentina, because I wrote about those 2 years ago in The Rebel. And I want to repeat those and share some of the things I wrote 2 years ago in case you don't remember them or never saw the article. It was the lead article of a magazine that was just being published on the Nazi connections to the murder of John Kennedy. But when the Zeiger family moved to Argentina, keep this in mind, it's in the article and I want to just state it again as easily as I can. A man named Alexander Zeiger lived in Poland and he moved to Argentina and then by some route became head of the Minsk radio factory where Oswald knew he was going to be assigned when he arrived in Moscow and told Priscilla Johnson, who worked for the CIA and the State Department. Mr. Zeiger hired Lee Oswald. He had several daughters who were friendly with Marina Oswald, whose father and family were from the Tsarist armies, white Russians. And when Lee Harvey Oswald applied to come home to the State Department, then he met Marina and they had a quick marriage, and I mean a quick marriage, no family attended, family or friends. They said the ceremony in Russia, and then he said, I want to bring her home too. And her application was passed over the conditions of the passport office of emigres of this type. The conditions numbered 212, the provisions, don't allow many Russian wives to come back to the United States, but our State Department said, come on, darling, we'll move you right into Dallas-Fort Worth, and you'll have a lot of friends, a lot of clothes, and a lot of money. I suppose that's the way it went, because the International Rescue Committee, a group of violently anti-communist people, met them in New York and then flew them from New York to Fort Worth. Now, she came home with Lee Oswald. Her papers were hurried through. At the time that she was meeting Lee Harvey Oswald in Minsk, Danilov had been in Moscow a long time, and a year, and she applied to marry Lee and applied to come back, connections through the Zeigers. And then, as I wrote several years ago in the Rebel article, at the time the Warren Commission was investigating the murder of John Kennedy, Isaac Don Levine came to them with a proposal, which I have a copy of in my files, wanting the CIA to send the daughters of the Zeigers back to Argentina. So there was a CIA, the State Department, collusion between where Oswald worked in Minsk, between his relationship in Moscow with Priscilla Johnson, and if her cover was a journalist the 3 years she was there, and she was CIA and State Department, then how far away do you have to scratch to get Nicholas Danilov with his background that he has, where he goes from London to Switzerland to Moscow, and he's there, even though Priscilla Johnson comes home by 1962, he's still there, and the favors from Marina were pressed through, and all they had to do was to go up to this embassy in Moscow one day, and money was waiting for them to come home. Now, continuing the New York Times story of September the 9th, Nicholas Danilov was longing to know more about his family. In order to do that, he had to snoop around with a lot of white Russians and Tsarists, because those are the people his family knew, and of course those are the people that would be hating the present Soviet government and hoping to overthrow it someday. He asked, where do I come from, what are the people like, and so forth. Danilov is, by all accounts, the kind of reporter the Soviet security authorities disliked the most, the New York Times said. His background seemed likely to mark him as a probable political enemy in KGB eyes. Because his great-grandfather, Alexander Frolov, was a member of the 19th-century revolutionaries that unsuccessfully tried to assassinate Tsar Nicholas I, going back to December 1825, he was a suspect. Great-grandpa tried to assassinate the Tsar. Grandpa was in the Tsar's intelligence. The father goes from Paris to Argentina to New Hampshire, and Nicky gets into Harvard and goes to Oxford. They unleash him in 1961 with UPI. In 1977, he's interfering with the House Select Committee on Assassinations. Dare they look into the Moscow connections, which G. Robert Blakey, of course, wouldn't do. And he comes home and then returns in 1981 for U.S. News and World Report. And he's described in the New York Times as having a love-hate relationship with the Soviets, and his wife says his own coverage of Soviet government activities was notably critical. Now, some more background on Nicholas Danilov from the New York Times. He had many Soviet friends. Nicholas Danilov had a lot of people that were in the Russian space exploits, and this is very, very important. I'm sorry I'm running out of time because I want to get on to that. I'll do it next week. His interest with Russian space, and he wrote a book about them. Now we have to put a search out for a book by Nicholas Danilov on the space program, because when Chernobyl and I believe it was sabotaged, I said there were people inside the Soviet Union who were sympathetic to the Thousand-Year Reich who could make sure that that plant was sabotaged and that Gorbachev didn't know about it for 2 days. I will begin next week, for sure, no matter what happens, talking about his interest in space research and other interesting things like chemical or rather biological weapons or disease in the Soviet Union and what kind of trouble that got him into. As I say, it's a shame to cut off now, but I'm going to pick it up next week because it is terribly important, the relationship of Danilov, so violently anti-Soviet, and his interest in the space program. In the meanwhile, this is Mae Brussel. You take care. Thanks for the books and articles, and World Watchers will continue with this very next week.